Hi, let me read a very interesting weekly routine to you. This is a real person's routine, by the way. Pilates, once a week. Strength training, once a week. Aqua therapy, once a week. Functional training, swimming, breathing exercises, daily meditation with just a little trouble. Golfing, 3 times a week, followed up with posture exercises. And very recently, experimenting with intermittent fasting. I'm sure you're imagining a very specific type of person, a really fit and disciplined person, perhaps even a fitness influencer. Well, you're kind of right. You could say that the person I'm talking about is very much an influencer, and he's fit too. He's huge on LinkedIn, where he's part of their top voice program. On Twitter, or X, he has close to 1 million followers. He's very popular online. So really, if you think about it, he could turn into a fitness influencer if he wanted to. But here's the thing, I'm not talking about a young, health-obsessed fitness influencer. Instead, what I read out was the routine of 72-year-old, health-obsessed, and I must add, restless founder and chairman of Marico, Harsh Mariwala. Dear listeners, welcome to First Principles, the weekly leadership podcast from The Ken. I'm your host, Rohin Dharmakumar, and this is part 2 of my conversation with Harsh Mariwala. Let's begin. As you said, life is learning, life is doing new things. And you're constantly trying to figure things out by doing them. Like, for example, meeting customers, markets, factories, offices, etc. What is continuous learning for you? What's your model, mental model of looking at continuous learning today?
So I think, first of all, whenever that mindset of, okay, I want to learn, whenever I get an opportunity. It need not be a structured learning. It could be just interaction with anybody. Is there some learning for me in that conversation or some observation or through reading or through listening? So there is always that strong desire, urge to learn. Of course, for me, it's in areas where I'm interested in. I don't understand too much technology, so if you ask me to understand technology, I will never be able to understand that. But there is a constant desire to learn. For example, when I'm doing my workout in the gym, 1.5 hours every day, there is always, I'm listening to some podcast. So to me, that's learning, you know. When I'm traveling, I get time to read books, you know. So normally, when I'm traveling, I read my books. When I'm in the car also, it's constantly, when I go for a walk, I listen to podcasts. So that open mind to learn something, which, and many a times it may not result in any learning, but I think spending energy, effort in trying to learn.
Do you find it hard to not do anything for even a few hours?
Yes. You're right, absolutely right. I have to be occupied all my time, So I have started doing meditation and all that just to calm me down. But otherwise, I have an active mind. And I want to go on doing things. So in a way...
How has your meditation journey been?
The teacher taught me. I mean, not a teacher, a friend who does meditation. I mean, she taught me to do for 30 minutes and I said, I can't do 30 minutes. So I've cut it down to 9 minutes.
This reminds me of a very good friend.
Sorry?
This reminds me of a very good friend who was introduced to meditation by another friend through an app. And he's like, this is too slow. I'm going to listen to it at 2x speed so that it can get over faster.
Yeah, but, you know, I'm just experimenting a lot of things these days. I'm into much more of a health trip, you know. So I'm doing 3. Just now, after this, at 6 o'clock, I have a 40-minute breathing session. So there's a breathing guy who is an expert on breathing. 40 minutes, different types of breathing. I'll do it with him virtually. So I am doing a lot of things. I've started doing intermittent fasting for last 1 month just to experiment, you know, what it means.
You're very interested in health and fitness. You said that you work out for about an hour and a half.
Yeah, I've lost 10 kilos in the last few years. Yeah.
What was the trigger for that?
It was just I wanted to feel fit.
And may I ask you, what's your fitness routine like?
So it's different on different days. Like twice a week, I'll do weights. Upper body, lower body, 1.5 hours. So today evening after that breathing, I have a weights session. But I'll do it in the gym, yeah. Otherwise, I have a trainer in Bombay. Once a week, I do Pilates. I have a trainer. Once a week, yoga. Then once a week, I go to the Aqua site. So many times, it's two things in one day, you know. And then 3 times a week, I play golf. So on the golfing days, I don't, because I'm spending 4 or 5 hours on the golf course. So I don't exercise other things. After golf, I do my posture exercise just to improve my posture. So I think, and one day a week, I do functional training, planks and all that. Yeah. And what then in addition to that, swimming, or I like to swim also, you know.
Is this something that you've always been interested in, fitness?
It was, but it's gone on increasing my overall, shall I say, thrust on my personal health also has gone on. So it's now mental health, meditation, breathing, a lot more.
So can we expect then perhaps a Marico Breathing Foundation?
No. Marico, no. I think it'll be, nothing like that.
No, I was just kidding only.
Yeah.
What are, in the last maybe 6 to 12 months, given that you're on this journey of also discovering newer aspects around fitness, what are some of the interesting things that you've personally learned, maybe new for you or like for anyone else around fitness, which are really on top of mind for you right now? Breathing seems to be one of them.
I mean, I just started learning breathing about a month back, and they say it's beneficial to you in terms of stress, in terms of better quality sleep, reducing anxiety, reducing impatience. I'm very impatient as a person, you know.
That is why I asked you earlier, do you find it hard to not do anything?
So, I think I go on trying, and there are many newer theories come up, you know. So, the intermittent fasting came up in the last few years. So, I'm just trying out last 1 month. I thought I'll find it very, very difficult to do that, but I'm able to do that. So, but I think you go on, there are newer and newer theories come up, you know, but I like to combine, at least in terms of my physical workouts, I like to combine different aspects, whether it is Pilates or whether it is yoga or functional training or weights. And I think get the right balance depending on your age and depending on what you want to achieve in terms of your health.
Is there something that we can do to get more people in India interested in active fitness?
Of course, a lot. The potential is huge in terms of spending time. But we have seen that the overall awareness for health, fitness has increased dramatically in the last few years. And it should increase much more. Because if you don't exercise, then it'll have impact on your health in terms of overweight or stress or whatever. So it's, to me, exercise is a big stress buster. It, depending on individual, again, some people music could be, some people it could be walk, it could be meditation. For me, it's exercise.
This is very famous, of course, former PayPal entrepreneur Peter Thiel, who's also like a VC. A very famous question that he asks entrepreneurs, which I want to put to you, which is, what important truth do very few people agree with you on? What is it that you believe in that few people would agree with?
It's a difficult question. I think it's amongst entrepreneurs, you know, there is a strong belief that you need to take shortcuts, you know, and don't pay as much attention on governance. And it's changing. But I think on governance, it's very important that you practice the highest standards of governance in the organization. Because if you are taking shortcuts, then you are creating a culture of taking shortcuts to meet certain challenges, and that will haunt you as you grow. So many entrepreneurs, especially in early stages, they don't pay as much attention on governance. Number two, in the area of talent, you know, many entrepreneurs, to them, HR is a function which is much, much lower hierarchy compared to some other functions like manufacturing or marketing. To me, HR is there on top of, on par with any other function, because ultimately it's the talent and the culture which will make you win the marketplace, you know. But people don't realize that this is one area they need to work upon. There is a war for talent, and that war for talent has to be dealt as seriously as war for market share or growth.
Have you seen this attitude changing when it comes to startups? Because increasingly younger startups, you see founders taking on the role of handling people and culture, etc. Compared to older organizations where it's seen as a function.
Yes.
Where HR is responsible for talent and attrition, etc.
Some extent, I don't know. I don't have that much detailed knowledge about the startups and, you know, how is it different. But I reckon that because they have built a new business based on some people and people's strengths, so I reckon they would be paying much more attention to relatively older organizations.
I want to switch tracks here a bit. Go back again to an interesting part in Marico's history. This was a period when one of the organizations earlier that you said that partly inspired you to start Marico Hindustan Unilever wanted to acquire Marico, and like in the competition and in the subsequent this thing, there was slashing of prices, deep discounts, capturing your market, etc. Of course, with the benefit of hindsight, we know that didn't happen.
Yeah.
Can you take us back through that period and what emerged from it and how you dealt with it?
So this happened in the year 1998 or so. We had just gone public.
In 96, you went public,
yes. So it happened immediately after, 1 or 2 years after we went public. And Levers had acquired Tomco, which is a Tata oil mills company. And one of the products through that acquisition was Nihar coconut oil. And that time, they were keen to grow through acquisitions. So they wanted to acquire us. And they went public in the sense that they said, okay, we'll acquire Marico. And they tried to approach me through bankers, directly also approached. And of course, when they didn't see that happening, they decided to scare us by saying that we will launch the product. We are far stronger, which they were, in terms of distribution. Their overall financial position. So there was a lot of fear in the organization, what will happen to us, whether we'll be able to take them on. But I was very clear that we will take them on because, as I said, I was not after money. If I was after money, I would have sold off the company and, you know, relaxed. But I was very clear that I will take them on in a business which I had built up, which we knew inside out. So where can they attack us in the area of the product? Of course, they could attack us in terms of advertising spend, in terms of distribution reach. But we took some steps on all those fronts, and then we decided to take them on. The market thought that we would not be able to survive, so our share prices fell down substantially. But over a period of time, they launched the product not once, but 2-3 times. They increased their market share, but they didn't get market share from us, from some other weaker players. So they went to a market share of about 15% or so. And at some stage,
What was your market share around?
It was about 50% or so. So at some stage, they started losing interest in this category because at that time, this product doesn't form a part of a global portfolio of Unilever, you know. So at that time, Hindustan Lever started getting more and more aligned to Unilever. And then they started neglecting that product or not investing in that product. Now, at some stage, I was able to convince them they're wanting to sell off, thinking that it'll come to me automatically. But they decided to put the brand on auction, and most other FMCG players participated in that acquisition auction. But we were very clear that we should get that acquisition. So we went a little bit overboard in terms of what we quoted. So we got that brand. So in a way, from selling it to them, we acquired the brand. And that was a big source of joy for us, huge celebration inside, emotional victory. So it was.
How long did this period last from them approaching you to you acquiring
it? It was quite a lot. We bought that brand in 2006. So first 2-4 years, they were active, then they were silent, then their market share also fell down from 15% to about 10-12% or so. So, but first 2-3 years were intensive competition. And then...
How was it like inside Marico during those years?
It was quite, some people thought I was mad. I was not selling out to them. My internal team was behind me. The field force, which is the sales force, distributors, they had a bigger battle in terms of fighting levers in the marketplace. But when they started seeing the results and not impacting us, then our confidence went on improving. And then ultimately, normally a strong brand gets least affected in a market share battle. The weaker brands lose out to the new entrant.
So it comes down to the strength of the brand in
the
minds of consumers.
We overinvested in that brand. We came up with an advertising campaign which leveraged the benefit of coconuts. You know, coconut is very auspicious. So when you go into a new house in India, you break a coconut. When you get married, you break a coconut. So we built a story around that, and that resonated with the customers.
I also want to talk about something which is connected, which I'm sure you've seen a lot of, which is really the way large conglomerates or organizations behave when it comes to competition.
Mm.
Now, you said that the Tata Group wanted to acquire you and then...
Levers.
Oh, sorry, my bad. The Levers. They acquired Tomco. My bad. Yeah. I mixed that up.
Yeah, no,
Levers wanted to acquire you and then they spent a lot of focus. Then they lost focus. Then finally, they decided to pull it on the block. Now, this is a common pattern that we've seen many times with large conglomerates because... The most what people don't realize from the outside is that organizational focus of conglomerates is a very precious resource and it does not last as long as startups and their founders' resolves.
Yeah.
What would you like to advise? Because you talked about D2C earlier and in many of those spaces, D2C entrepreneurs will go up at some point inevitably against a conglomerate that says, I'm going to destroy you.
Yeah.
How should they learn to think about the way conglomerates behave about competition and disruption?
So I think first of all, now let me give our own example, how we behaved. And there will be learnings from that to the potential person who's facing that threat. First of all, for us, it was everything. 70% of our turnover or 60% of our turnover came from Parachute. It was... highly profit-making, and we called it our resource-generating engine. And we came to the conclusion that we had to protect our resource-generating engine, come what may. So I think that was a starting point. Number two, it was so important to us that it got attention at the topmost level, starting from me to the head of those who were reporting to me, head of marketing sales, that we had to take them out. So there was a very high-level attention given to this fight. From our side. Now, what happens in a company like Lever? This becomes one out of maybe 50 brands there. It gets delegated to two levels below the CEO, two or three levels below. They don't have the right same mindset to drive this. And because it is handled at middle senior level, it is not given as much attention. And we knew that, you know, it will not get attention. And sometimes... it all depends on to which extent they want to win in the marketplace for how long. And sometimes they just give up because this was not a part of the global portfolio. So they just gave it up, you know. You need to have the courage of your conviction to take that battle. You need to ensure that it gets top attention. Don't be emotional about that decision, but rational. You know, in this case, while taking them on, we evaluated each and every aspect of the scenario where they can hit us, and we took corrective action. Went and met also, at that time they were taking a battle with Nirma. I met Karsan Bhai Patel, went to Ahmedabad, meet him, just trying to find out what should we be doing.
Enemy of the enemy is my friend, sort of thing.
Not friend, but just to get insight in terms of what does he think. So he also agreed with me. And then, so I think just this reinforced the decision to take them on. So I think the key thing is to look at what kind of game you want to play in the marketplace.
And also hope, like that focus, it's hard for a large organization to sustain it over a period of time because people come and go.
Correct.
Organizational priorities keep changing.
Yeah, here it is case, the entrepreneur
is existential to the organization itself.
Yeah.
From our research, it's very clear that you love mental models, right? Like you approach decision-making, organization building, expansion, etc., through a process of mental models, etc. Are there any mental models which you find yourself frequently referring to when you're faced with tough decisions, which are your favorites in some senses?
Not really. I didn't even know that I'm following mental models.
There are frameworks that you use. I mean, maybe a different word would be perhaps frameworks of growth or strategy, etc., and stuff like that.
I don't remember having any particular framework in mind, but yes, frameworks we use in terms of analyzing what can happen. So it's more analysis and different depending on the what issue you're facing. How do you create a right to win, or what should we be doing when you launch a brand? It should be, I mean, normally it will go through a process of a brand should be easily memorable,
got it.
Easy to pronounce, things like that, you know.
Got it.
But yeah.
You said,
I mean, there is a certain process which we follow. It may not be captured in a proper framework, but a certain process you follow, even when it comes to, say, meetings.
Yeah.
A lot of organization time goes into meetings, you know, and most of the members in the organization feel frustrated when they get invited to meetings. But for a meeting, you have to be very clear. What is the objective of the meeting? Who is called in that meeting? Not every person who should be called. The meeting has to start on time, because one or two key persons coming half an hour late means 10 other people are waiting for half an hour. Has to start on time. And then meetings will not have any PowerPoint presentation because they waste a lot of time. So you send materials to read in advance. It is taken as read. Only dialogues happen through the meeting. And the chair of the meeting has to ensure that each person who is present in the meeting gets an opportunity to speak. And dominant speakers will be invited last by the chair to speak. And then at the end of the meeting, there'll be a critique session. How did the meeting go? What were the positives? What are the negatives? And then after that, the minutes have to go within 2 days after the meeting is over. The next meeting starts with the review of the minutes of the earlier meeting, if it is the same group which meets again and again. So I'm just saying that there is a certain process we follow. And I'm just giving a meeting example to ensure that you follow that process. Because if you follow a certain process, then the execution is far better.
Hi, it's me, Rohin, again. Since we've started First Principles, I've met around 35 founders and CEOs on this show. I've loved every single one of the conversations I've had. In fact, I think I'm a better professional and entrepreneur today due to the many insights and tips that emerged from these conversations. But I'd be lying if I also didn't admit that of late, I've been wondering if our episodes and conversations are getting a bit too predictable and linear. Now, I hate predictability, both as a person and as a journalist. So my first instinct is to try and change things radically. But what do you think? Is First Principles becoming a bit too safe, predictable, and linear for you too? No? Yes? I'd love to hear lots of feedback and tips from you, my dear listener, on what we can do to innovate First Principles even further. Whether it's our questions, our conversation formats, our topics, or even our guests. Please do write into us at fp@theken.com. That's fp@the-ken.com. Thank you. Do you remember when and why you said there would be no PowerPoints in meetings?
No, because it's a waste of time, you know, and most of the time, all the consultants, they put so much data in the slide that there's a conflict in terms of reading what is written there versus hearing what they're saying. And you can always read that earlier and be ready, and, you know, so you don't need that kind of, when so much of data in those PowerPoint presentations that you can't even read. Half the time you're battling in terms of reading that what is written in the PowerPoint presentation.
There is also this theory that if there is a presentation, the person who's making the presentation feels like he or she is selling an idea to the rest of the room.
Yeah.
So they feel more defensive about what is being presented. The moment you remove that,
so it if kind there of is reduces. Subject, then that person is asked to sum up, not through PowerPoint, just sum up what is contained in the presentation, what that person wants to get from the group, you know.
All right.
Yeah.
I want to latch on to a word that
even in our board meetings also, we don't have PowerPoint presentations. And I'm on some external boards also. I've been able to influence that. Please reduce all your PowerPoint presentation. It's a waste of time.
All right. One of the words that you said in your earlier answer when I asked you about frameworks was analysis.
Mm.
Now, analysis is the act of taking something, a problem before you, and being able to break it up into smaller pieces and try to figure out a solution to it. The opposite of that is synthesis.
Yeah.
Which is essentially looking at the big picture and trying to see the connections. Now, synthesis is much less appreciated than analysis.
Yeah.
Whereas for entrepreneurs, and especially given that you've built an organization so long, sometimes I'm sure your best and most creative answers came by figuring out the connections that existed.
Yeah.
Is there a way that you try to teach synthesis to others or get them to appreciate it?
I don't know. I'm not able to answer that question.
All right.
I think what you're saying, get a holistic picture and draw the connections. But how to teach others, I don't know. But you have to get a holistic picture, that's for sure.
That's right.
And you need to ensure that what are the different things which get connected to make that holistic picture far more effective.
That's right. Like, absolutely.
But how to do it, I don't know. But I know what to do.
All right. You are constantly learning. How do you archive or store insights? Are you a memory person or are you a notes person?
I'm a notes person completely. I'm not a memory person. I forget what I discuss with you. If you ask me 1 hour later, I'll forget. You know.
So what is your notes method? Like, do you take smartphone notes?
So I always write down whenever in
pen
a meeting,
paper?
I pen and paper for every board. For example, I have a book. For every board, I have a book. What gets discussed is written in the book. So it just, if I want to refer, I just refresh myself. So I am a strong believer that my mind is not for memory, it is for analysis and, you know, getting results rather than memorize what is. So I keep the mind free.
Find yourself going back to your notes?
That's the whole objective. If need be, I can go back to my notes. Yeah. So after every meeting, I'll write down what are the key things. So if I have a follow-up meeting, then I'll know exactly these are the key things I need to take action on.
How are you as a person different from you as a professional? Are there two selves? There are the differences between the personal Harsh and the
professional? No, not really. I think it's very much, even in terms of the purpose of the organization, it's very, very similar, that making a difference. That's my personal purpose and the organization's purpose also. And we did a lot of inciting before we finalized the organization purpose, but a lot of me has rubbed off on the organization, in terms of the values, the culture, and my thought process. So
that's natural.
I am not able to differentiate between me, the person, and me, the professional. It's very integrated, I would say. Yeah.
What are your weekends like?
Weekends are golf on Saturday and Sunday, without fail. Last weekend I was traveling, so no golf. But otherwise, my son and my grandchildren, they stay in Dubai, so they are away. But it's basically socializing in the evenings. Normally on Saturdays, one would do something together. But I'm not I socialize, but I'm not like every day I socialize, you know.
In our research, it also came up that growing up at a younger age, you were introverted.
Yeah, I've changed a lot in the last few years. I would not be able to speak in front of an audience. Even
you said last few years.
Maybe last 10, 20 years. Yeah.
Hmm.
But if you asked me to speak 15, 20 years back, I would shudder to speak in front of 10, 20 people. Now I can talk in front of 2,000 people.
How did you solve that? By just forcing yourself
I've realized that if you're prepared, and I can speak well on subjects I know, but if you give me a subject which I'm not, then I'm still shudder, you know. Because I know exactly what is the subject, I know what to talk. And earlier I used to make PowerPoint presentation and talk, but now all my talks are more extempore.
A theme that I see running across many of the things that you do is ecosystem.
Yeah.
Marico Innovation Foundation,
yes.
Ascent.
Yeah.
I saw the word ecosystem even in Sharp Ventures, which is your family investment fund, etc.
Yeah. Yeah.
Everything that you're doing seems in some way designed to be interconnected to something else.
Yes.
Which is, how do you see, when did you get interested in ecosystems and how do you view the act of creating and connecting ecosystems in what you do?
I don't know, maybe when, I think the starting point is to make a difference, you know, and when one is your own company managing, and when my, I think maybe the ecosystem creation came in much more after I stepped down from Marico in terms of creating an influence and creating an ecosystem for innovation or entrepreneurship or in the area of mental health or in the area of investing, you know. So basically, it starts with a desire to be a thought leader in area, pioneer. So I get attracted by pioneering initiatives, thought leadership initiatives, where you want to do something where others respect you, you know. They come to you. So when you do some work in that particular area, you can't do it on your own. You have to create an ecosystem where you interact with all the other relevant people who can add value in that ecosystem.
What is it that continues to drive you today?
I don't know. It's something which is genetic. It is genetic because it's something which I enjoy doing it. I learn. But inside all that, there is that desire to do something. You know, it's just not desire to relax and not do anything.
Over the years, talent and culture has been very close to the way you've built organizations. Has there been something that you've changed your mind about when it comes to developing and growing people? A younger Harsh versus...
Yeah, maybe in the initial stages, just to give an example, when you were working, I had a contractual mindset, a winning mindset, you know, that it's not a win-win. I want to win, others can lose, you know.
Zero-sum game.
Whether it is buying some material from some contractors or working with our laborers where that desire to win was high and, you know, it's okay others lose. But it's over a period of time, I said, if for building lasting relationships, it has to be win-win, you know. The other party also has to feel that they won in this negotiation or whatever. So, and that's far more lasting, far more sustainable and far better way to move forward.
That's very interesting because, I mean, another way to kind of put this win-lose versus win-win situation is a scarcity mentality versus an abundance mentality. Mm. I mean, a lot of us Indians have been raised in a system where there is scarcity is implied,
yeah.
Right? If I'm standing in a queue and if somebody else wants to get in front of me, I'm getting delayed, right?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
If he or she is winning something, I'm losing.
Okay.
Well, versus the abundance mentality is, I think, fine, you can get in.
Yeah.
We'll both kind of get in.
Yeah.
What caused this change? Because it's not easy. You came from a traditional business family and like, you know, without stereotyping, I think in the pre-licensed Raj era, it was in many ways a zero-sum game.
No, so when you have that win-lose kind of approach and then it doesn't last for a longer period of time. That problem haunts you after a few years. Then you realize that why the problem is coming. For example, if you are able to, I mean, we had a 9-month strike with our laborers and we drove a hard bargain. At that time, feeling happy and they were feeling little. Within 3 years, there's one more strike because they were feeling cheated, you know. So then you realize, okay, you made a mistake in terms of driving that win-lose kind of a situation. You know.
Is negotiations and leaving value on the table something that you take seriously? Like if I were to kind of broaden that into...
I would think so, but I don't... And in my business, there's not much of negotiation coming in. But ultimately, both parties should be happy. That's what... If negotiation, you need to arrive at a situation which is sound. I mean, neither party should take advantage of the other party. But on a soundness basis, both are happy, and in negotiation, that's a good negotiation. Yeah.
Do you also read books? You said
I read a lot of books, yeah.
What's your method for reading
books? Goes
is it
on
Kindle,
changing
physical
now.
Books?
No, physical. No Kindle. No, it has to be physical. I have to mark I have to mark, underline what is read in the book. I tell my secretary to type out what is underlined. All the underlined portion is put in, pasted in another book. Sometimes I just leave through the underlined portion.
Also, you've got like a meta book, which is filled with insights from all the other books.
Like not one, but 5-6 meta books.
All right. And do you find the time to go back to your meta book every
Depending
now and then?
Depending on, I used to do it more often earlier. But
so that's one of the biggest things, right? You take notes, but do you go back?
Absolutely.
Interesting. Could you tell us some of the more interesting books that you might recommend for us from any time over the last maybe year or so? Anything
interesting? I think in terms of personal, but these are books which are known, I'm sure you know.
That's all right.
Man's Search for Meaning and then, you know, Grit, which is, you know, when you have overcome certain failure, you know, and everybody has those failures and how do you bounce back? So the grit rather than passion, you know, so passion combined with determination and perseverance. And then talk about all the stakeholders important in any organization, which was written by Jagdish Sheth and Raj Sisodia, talking of all the stakeholders are important, not just shareholders. So you have to look at all stakeholders' interests, whether it's employees, associates, society, shareholders. You have to try to get maximize everyone's interest. And that's what makes a corporation far more impactful over a period of time. And they've done study in terms of organizations which are taking interest of all the stakeholders are able to do much better financially than only organizations which are looking at the shareholders, you know. So, and then improving board effectiveness through Ram Charan. So a lot of books. I'm not able to single out one or two books. Yeah.
I want to connect two, three strands that you talked about earlier. One is you talked about working with various professors, Indian origin professors who are now abroad, working with them. You talked about the Marico Innovation Foundation. You talked about case studies and working with business schools, etc., in order to kind of analyze those case studies. You talked about learning. Now, I see something at the intersection of all of this that is there a better way to learn and teach about businesses and innovation in India? Because there seems to be something here that you're working with, you know, professors abroad, you're working with colleges in India. It's all around Indian innovation and local innovation, etc. I mean,
surely, yes, especially business schools, I always feel that they're disconnected from the businesses. They have to be far more higher. Of course, the students are now doing summer training and getting exposed to industry. But more importantly, professors, you know, and I don't know any professors coming in, working in any of the schools of business, you know. So they have to be interacting much more with the industry. They have to start consulting. Because their salary levels are low, if they are allowed to consult, then they'll make much more money. They'll be far more present in highly disruptive environment, you know, what are the disruptions happening and whether it's technology or whatever geopolitical disruptions and how organizations are able to cope up with all these disruptions, you know. So I personally think there has to be a much, much stronger bond with the industry and the teaching.
Academia.
And also the whole system of case study based learning has limitations, you know, because a lot of issues are to be dealt with people and they don't teach leadership style and how to get the best out of people. To me, people-related issues are...
What's a better way to, for instance, teach some of the learnings from Marico, for instance, to prospective Indian students and in colleges?
No, I think there have been some case studies which are written about Marico, which could
be... I get that, but that's like, to take like your point, it's case studies, static case studies.
I don't know whether, you know, not necessarily Marico, but other organizations which are doing some differential work, are there enough opportunities for the students to learn from these organizations? Are professors, ultimately professors have to mix a lot with the industry, capture insights out of so many organizations and translate that into their own teaching to students. To me, they will be the most important influence to the students and they have to go out and meet and interact with industry to capture the learning so that it gets translated into their teaching style or communication. So, you know?
They are the pollinators in that sense.
I think so, yeah. And then you have the case study and, you know, those kind of pedagogy. But otherwise, professors can play a very important role.
Thank you so much for your time today, Ash.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it.
Thank you.